This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Axis Mundi.
On July 4th, 2026, the U.S. government will celebrate the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The Trump administration and its allies have been preparing for this important anniversary for years already, making plans for a big military parade in Washington, D.C. Reports are that several of the cultural institutions in D.C. that have been seized by the administration, like the Kennedy Center, will host events in the lead-up to the anniversary. Events that celebrate the courageous actions of early American colonists to rise up against the tyrannical king for the sake of freedom. Events that will, no doubt, present the founding of the United States and its history in a very particular and uncomplicated light. A framing loyal to white Christian nationalism, thus serving to legitimate and cement its place as the primary ideology shaping American governance. Here's the great irony. Contained within the Declaration of Independence is this line: governments are instituted among men, deriving their powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government. This document and this line are revolutionary. They legitimate and encourage resistance, the right and the duty of the people to overthrow a government that restricts rights. They say that we, the people, the governed, are the ones who decide what kind of government we want. Of course, we must remember that the audience intended for that call to resistance at the time was narrowly defined. The right to revolt that they affirmed was, in the minds of many of our founders, reserved for white men only. Those words were, in fact, written by a rich white man who himself enslaved people, Thomas Jefferson. And this same document enshrines the words merciless savages to refer to those indigenous to this land. This is a thoroughly American document reflecting our democratic ideals, our social hierarchies, and our original sins. But it's that revolutionary spirit within the Declaration of Independence, that call to resist a government that restricts individual rights, that poses a potential problem for the Trump administration. Because in this year that will draw so much attention to that document, our Declaration of Independence, what if those in the United States were to read that line en masse and take it seriously? What if they were to apply it to our current context in which a president is acting an awful lot like a tyrannical king? What trouble might it make for the regime?
So it's no wonder the Trump administration is working hard to control the narrative surrounding the 250th anniversary, putting so much money into preparation for a splashy commemoration, seizing control over museums and other cultural institutions in D.C. in advance. No wonder they want to turn this national celebration of freedom and resistance into a jingoistic affair, to showcase the might of the world's greatest military power on our streets, to ensure no historians nor artists insert activism into this dangerous moment. It's an old story, one those of us who are Christian and Jewish are probably familiar with, because it's not unlike the Roman Empire's annual military parade at the start of the Jewish Passover in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago, one Christians recall each year on Palm Sunday. Passover, remember, is a festival celebrating the Jews' freedom from oppression. It is a week-long collective remembering in scripture, ritual, and nightly gatherings, God's challenge to worldly authorities who oppress, and God's power and promise of liberation. The Roman governor of Jerusalem, Pontius Pilate, he didn't want the Jews to get any ideas that this message applied to them then. So every year at the start of this freedom festival, Pilate offered an imperial show of force to remind Jews to stay in their place, to intimidate them. Can the same be said of Trump now? Let's be real. The administration is right to be afraid. The Declaration of Independence, the call to resistance within it, it threatens Trump's increasingly authoritarian rule, his growing suppression of individual rights. What if Americans took that document's call to resist authoritarianism, to rise up against a wannabe king, seriously, as activists, patriots, as people of faith? What democratic action might we inspire? What new era of renewed democracy might we inaugurate? What power might we claim?
Welcome to American Unexceptionalism. I'm Matthew Taylor.
And I'm Susie Hayward. This is the show where we ask what Americans can learn from those who have resisted religious nationalism and authoritarianism around the globe.
We interview scholars and activists about the strategies they used, the lessons they learned in their fight against oppressive religious regimes.
The United States is facing a very serious Christian nationalist threat to democracy. But we aren't alone in this fight. It's time to put our American exceptionalism behind us to learn how to create a future for all of us.
Welcome to our final episode. That's right, episode 10 here is where this limited series ends. And instead of doing another interview, Susie and I want to reflect on the lessons we've gleaned from these 8 case studies in resisting religious authoritarianism around the world. We want to try to translate this into some very concrete and straightforward advice, a playbook, so to speak, from our friends and partners around the world, mediated through Susie and me. It's a playbook for how to build a resilient, agile and nonviolent resistance movement to MAGA Christian authoritarianism. First, let's review where we've been. We started in Brazil and South Korea with the scholars João Chaves, Raimundo Barreto, and then Ray Kim and Helen Jin Kim. And we discovered how countries that are very similar to the United States and that overlap with our culture greatly, Brazil and South Korea, are also places where activists have successfully protected democracy from far-right Christian nationalist actors attempting power grabs. Then we traveled to Southeast and South Asia to learn about Buddhist and Hindu forms of nationalism that display eerily similar forms of political and social strategies to shore up ethnic majoritarian power. We learned from David Moe and Geetika Dharmasinghe, and also from Anant Rambachan and Nikhil Mandalaparthi, diaspora scholars who are also working to dismantle religious nationalism back in their home countries. We were inspired by the story of the Aragalaya. Did I get that right, Susie?
That'll work.
In Sri Lanka. The uprising in which the people came together to overthrow a Buddhist nationalist, authoritarian wannabe president from office. In each of these test cases, we explored the transnational connections between far-right religious and political actors and movements in which Americans are quite active. We talked about these transatlantic and trans-Pacific flights to support one another, their shared tactics and language, even across lines of religious and ethnic difference. Welcome to the pluralist fascist coalition. Nowhere is that more clear and obvious than in Israel and Palestine. And Natalia Omer and Ben Lorber helped us to locate Israel within this larger constellation of democracies being overtaken by far-right parties and religious nationalism. Turkey served as our bridge between East and West, where we learned from Ayşe Kadifeki Orellana about democratic resistance to Islamic nationalism and Erdogan's attacks on Turkish democracy. We heard about the valiant resistance of Pikachu and dug more deeply into the particular narratives and consequences around gender and sexuality that always accompany anti-democratic backsliding and forms of ethno-religious nationalism. And we ended in Europe, both Western and Eastern Europe. We learned about the Catholics in Poland from Joel Day and Jonathan Lomaskolo, and also about the Orthodox far-right networks and power centers in Russia with Regina Elsner and Sarah Riccardi-Swartz. We discovered that these styles of European Christianity inspire U.S. far-right groups. And we recognized some of the resistance of courageous women activists and cross-border feminist networks.
Our global exploration has given us some clear warnings. First, that these far-right transnational alliances are active and they're strong. Anti-democracy is a global movement and a global moment, and it's very well organized, has tight and effective messaging, has had a lot of successes. It's dismantled or weakened the traditional institutional systems of international cooperation that were established after World War II, like the UN and the EU. So we can't depend on those any longer to contain these forces, at least not in the same way we used to be able to. And religion, even a strange form of contradictory interreligious learning and solidarity, is a key to its infrastructure and narrative. That is precisely what we're calling the pluralist fascist coalition. And in this Trump era, the United States is fast on track to join that pluralist fascist alliance. We have to resist now while we still can. Myanmar, Turkey, Russia, they serve as warnings to us that when these things get out of hand, they can degrade into totalitarianism or civil war. And we've also learned that resistance can be effective when we gather and do it. In South Korea, in Brazil, in Sri Lanka, we have seen how it can work. Which direction will the U.S. go? The next year may very well determine the answer to that question. Authoritarian consolidation doesn't always happen that quickly. In Brazil, in Hungary, and other countries, it took longer. But the pace of capture here over the past 11 months has been much faster than it ever was in any of those places. So we need to pick up our pace as well in order to stop it in its tracks. Without broad public participation, we're not going to be successful. And that participation and resistance, it has to go beyond the traditional modes like street protests, statements, even nonviolent direct action. And it has to include diverse coalitions, racially, generationally, politically. Defections are going to be important. More about that in a moment. Right now, we're seeing some of these forms of resistance in the U.S., but not enough, because our society, it's still incredibly polarized, and many folks are falling back on the usual forms of resistance, and that's being led by the usual people. The labor movement, which is so key to effective resistance worldwide, it's weak in the U.S., thanks to decades of erosion. So we've got some work to do, and we have to remember that it's up to us to do that work, because no one institution is going to save us. Not Congress, not the courts, not universities, not any billionaire, not the Democratic Party. It's up to us, the people, and it takes all of us.
But we have reason to hope. Again, we've seen powerful examples of success in this global moment. Think about the people of South Korea taking to the streets within hours of the far-right president attempting to institute martial law. Think about the Aragalaya. Did I get it better that time? Aragalaya. The uprising in Sri Lanka that deposed a dictator non-violently and joyfully. They threw a pool party in his mansion. They overthrew the tyrannical regime. We can have that too. We've also have this incredible opportunity here in the U.S., right? And that's part of what we've been exploring in this series, because we can connect with the broader resistance movements, even here in our diverse citizenry. We've seen examples of this pushback in the U.S. What happened with Jimmy Kimmel? 1.7 million people canceled their Disney Plus accounts because of Jimmy Kimmel. And it changed the way that the administration and the actors in that confrontation responded. We've seen Epstein and the Epstein files get pushed and pushed and pushed, and they don't have a message to fix that one, right? The No Kings rallies have been very successful in mass mobilizing big chunks of the U.S. population. Trump doesn't have control over us. He doesn't even have control over his own MAGA movement. Look at the defection of Marjorie Taylor Greene. We are seeing a growingly organized mobilization across the U.S., particularly in cities that are experiencing this occupation. Los Angeles, Charlotte, D.C., Chicago, New Orleans. People are coming out. People are resisting. Local movements are learning from each other, and they're growing more effective. We are not in full-blown authoritarianism, fascism, or totalitarianism. It might feel like it sometimes, because democracy has been eroded so much, we've lost a lot in a very short period of time, but we aren't Myanmar. We aren't Russia. I know it felt awful at the beginning of 2025. Doge was cutting like a scythe through valuable government agencies and services. People were getting fired left and right. It felt like there was no stopping the hard-charging Trump agenda. But since then, we've learned that Trump's agenda is extremely unpopular and fragile because he's not doing anything that he promised. He's dangerous, but he's also an addled old man who can't think around corners anymore. This is the moment, 2026, the 250th anniversary of when our citizen ancestors fought a revolution to say there is no divine right of kings, and the government derives its power from the consent of the governed. This is the time to resist the authoritarian slide. Trump is weak. He's vulnerable because he can't stop harming and abusing the very people who voted for him.
And Matt, you mentioned the cities that are experiencing military presence or occupation by ICE. We're experiencing that in Minneapolis this week. And I can tell you, I can witness that we are seeing signs that local democracy is coming alive in a way that I have never seen before. We have had neighbors developing these community defense networks, coming together, working with state-level elected officials to share information and to coordinate, providing mutual aid, patrols for schools, protecting places of worship. These relationships at the local level are becoming so strong, and the organization and the mobilization so robust and diverse to what you were speaking to. And again, we're learning, just like you said, from activists in other cities who have faced this threat before us. They're calling us up and doing webinars and just downloading the lessons that they've learned so that we can start from a place of strength. And I wonder to myself sometimes this week, is this like a new great awakening of democracy that I am witnessing here?
And we've heard about the authoritarian playbook. We've talked about the authoritarian playbook. We've seen it across the world in our case studies. It's things like erode independent media.
That's right. We've just had the lawsuits against different media firms. And these days you look around and nearly all the big media networks are owned at this point by Trump allies and billionaires, Jeff Bezos and others. It's beginning to look a lot like Russia here.
Part of the playbook is they try to capture independent institutions.
Like universities, or the Kennedy Center, or the U.S. Institute of Peace, or museums, or religious groups, or law firms.
Authoritarian leaders punish their opposition.
James Comey, or Letitia James. Heck, even John Bolton.
They scapegoat and demonize minorities.
Immigrants, including Somali immigrants in Minneapolis right now, and trans people.
Look around the globe. These authoritarians will use military and security forces on their domestic population.
Yeah, we're seeing that with ICE and Customs and Border Patrol right now in Minneapolis. And we've also seen the National Guard mobilized in various cities against U.S. citizens.
Authoritarians undermine trust in elections and election systems.
I mean, the 2020 election lie.
They weaken checks and balances.
Yeah, and we've been seeing Trump do this by getting in the legislature's lane with Congress, even contributing to its shutdown, politicizing and stacking the judiciary to the degree that the courts aren't serving as the forms of checks that they normally would.
And as we talked about in the last episode, if the authoritarian nationalism happens to have more of an imperialist flavoring, they start invading or threatening to invade nearby countries to enlarge the authoritarian's grasp on more territory.
Think claiming Greenland or the Panama Canal, or menacing Venezuela by blowing up boats in a manner that violates the laws of war, saying that those are narco-traffickers, but offering little proof of that. All of it really seemingly a chest-pumping threat of regime change against Maduro, which, of course, just resonates with U.S. historical imperialism in Latin America.
So we know what plays the other
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Your side is executing. What about the Democratic resistance playbook? That's what we'd like to spend the rest of this episode on. What are the practical lessons we can take away from our world tour of religious authoritarianisms? So we have 10 of these points here that we'd like to share. We're going to go quickly through all of them. Number one, build broad, diverse coalitions.
This was so key in so many of the places where we saw success in South Korea, in Sri Lanka. And obviously in the U.S., this means diverse coalitions with respect to race, class, geography, generation, religion, all of those identity markers. And it even means diversity across partisan lines. To the extent Republicans want to join the movement to protect democracy, heck yeah, come join us. And it's going to mean some things that are going to be a little difficult for us. It's going to mean letting go of some old grudges. It's going to mean not operating in our traditional issue area silos, focusing only on one particular constituency or group. And we're going to need to reject purity politics, the idea that we have to agree on everything in order to be able to work together. This is an all hands on deck moment. So I can tell you just by way of example, recently I was at a training that included a lot of folks from the Sunrise Movement, a youth-led climate justice movement, and the NDN Collective, which focuses on indigenous rights. And the leaders of both groups were saying, we have an immediate threat that we need to pivot to right now. And we need to work with other groups and coalitions that we might not normally work with because we're doing slightly different issue areas. But we're all focusing right now on authoritarianism. And this is also going to mean inviting new folks into the movement whenever they come knocking. You may wish that folks had shown up earlier. You may be upset that their actions or positions earlier, some of which were a direct front to your own rights and dignities, led us to where we are now. I completely get that. Manage those feelings in a way you need to, because folks are not going to join the resistance if they're met with judgment and anger when they do show up. We need to welcome them in because we need them.
Absolutely. And yeah, this purity politics, it's got to go. We need the biggest tent, most inclusive, most welcoming coalition possible. If you agree that Donald Trump is an authoritarian threat to American democracy, then you are part of our coalition. For example, I have heard of these instances where pro-life feminist groups have been excluded from some protest against Trumpism because they are pro-life. Whoever is not our enemy is our friend, at least in the cause of American democracy. Abortion is an important conversation. It's an important policy debate that we need to have. But people on both sides of that issue can be opposed to authoritarianism. Right? If you believe that Donald Trump is an authoritarian threat to our democracy, then you are part of the coalition. Recall the question that Helen Kim posed. Is your Christianity supportive of authoritarianism or not? That is the kind of question that should be the North Star of the anti-Trump coalition. Are you someone who supports equality and rights for all and who opposes authoritarianism? Then you're with us. Whatever you think about LGBTQ rights or charter schools or gun rights or abortion, those are all very, very important debates that we can hash out through democratic processes if and when we still have a democracy. But if Trump and his coalition remain in power, I can guarantee that no one listening to this podcast is going to like what they do with respect to those rights. So we need to stand against this stuff together.
And who knows, maybe the relationships forged now to fight for democracy will create some surprising new alliances and dynamics in the future on those hot button issues. Research shows that when authoritarianism is stopped or overthrown, democracy is stronger and deeper on the other side, better able to handle nonviolently those kinds of debates. I've been thinking this week about the role of the police here as we think about broad coalitions and the odd bedfellows that are going to be naturally a part of them. I'm watching these tensions play out in Minneapolis right now. There's so much mistrust of the police in Minneapolis for good reason. This is the place where George Floyd was murdered by police officers and Philando Castile and other unarmed Black men, a place where the police have been under investigation because of their violence towards American citizens. So building back trust between the police and the community after Floyd's murder, it has not been easy. We are not there yet. And so I think sometimes what is going to encourage the police or the National Guard, if they are called up and sent in to Minnesota, to stand with the community against aggressive armed action by federal actors or against illegal federal orders that are given, like to arrest protesters or to use violence against them. And the reality is that it's less likely if the community is calling them all bastards. And this is a really tough one. This week here in Minneapolis, we've actually seen instances where the police have defended the community against ICE. Something has shifted. I've actually seen some activists who are looking up and they're like, wait a minute, are the police actually showing up and defending and protecting us and our neighbors right now against these armed federal actors? So I don't know, maybe there's a glimmer of something there. Okay, in the first episode, y'all might remember that I mentioned this gathering of women from around the world in my friend's living room in 2016. We had invited them in order to offer advice to American women from their own lived experience of authoritarianism or contexts of religious nationalism or political violence, their suggestions and advice to us about how to care for our souls and our communities in these contexts. I recall a remark from one of my Libyan friends that night. She said to us, "I wish that we had open doors to more people to be with us, even those who'd been a part of Gaddafi's world, but people who wanted out. We didn't trust them. We didn't want them. So we kept those doors shut. We maintained the polarization of society. And then those divides became the fault lines for mass violence and for civil war." Her words have really been sticking with me recently.
All right. So playbook number one, build big, broad coalitions. Number two, let the youth create the ethos of the movement to innovate and to make it fun. If you're going to build a resilient resistance movement, you need joy and energy. And young people have got it. They are savvy. They're idealistic. They're comfortable with diversity. They don't think in simplistic binaries. They aren't stuck in all the old ways of thinking, and we need to help innovate and find solutions, and they are the right people to do it. They've got the vision. Let's put them in the front of this.
Yeah, and a particular shout out to the Sunrise Movement right now for what they're doing as a youth-led movement to contribute all of those elements to the resistance. Okay, number three in our Democratic Resistance playbook. Use culture, art, religion, national symbols, music, different kinds of creative performance. I hate to break it to you, academics, but good discursive arguments are not going to do it. They're important, they have a place, but they're insufficient in themselves. We need to draw on the power of symbols and rituals, of songs, of hymns. These things evoke history. They evoke deep-seated feelings and values. They draw on a world of meaning. Authoritarians depend on them precisely for those reasons, and they use them for those reasons, especially national symbols. This gets us back to the Declaration of Independence. So we have to reclaim them, and we have to direct the power that they channel towards the vision of what it is we're fighting for. E pluribus unum, equal justice under law, freedom for everyone.
Yeah, those patriotic symbols and patriotic claims, that's so, so important to this. Because if we can say, we are patriots too, we love our country, we love the values of the founding, then we are tapping into these bigger audiences. If it's all just kind of criticize American history, and there's plenty of room to criticize. But if it's only negative, if it's only a frustration, then we aren't uniting people. Part of the goal here is to depolarize our society, and the national symbols are there for that.
Okay. The American flags, too, having them at all of these gatherings, the No Kings gatherings, the rallies. It's important.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Okay, number four. Humor is the weakest chink in the authoritarian's armor. They hate being made fun of. They don't have a good response. Use that to the nth degree. Pikachu costumes, frog costumes, clowns joining the National Guard lines, playing the Imperial March song from Star Wars. These are all examples of how we poke holes in their armor, of how we challenge the very premise of their reign. Talking about the context of authoritarianism, humor isn't just silliness. Humor represents strength. It represents confidence. Humor is disarming. Humor speaks to everyone.
And it just undermines the argument that the regime is making that protesters are thugs, a racialized term, or that protesters are violent, or protesters are some sort of dark and evil force in some of the religious terms, demonic forces.
Extremists.
Yes. Pussy Riot said in their statement that I read last time,
yep,
Pikachu on the streets is not extremist. Okay, number five in the playbook. Women need to take the lead of this movement, and their causes need to be central to how we organize the resistance. And this might get messy with some of those elements that Matt was speaking to earlier, but that's okay. We need to be focusing on the issues that affect all women because they're the canaries in the coal mine and they affect all of our community. And not only that, women are 50% of the population. So mobilizing women in particular has an incredible amount of power on issues like equal pay, issues like protection from harassment and domestic violence. These are issues that matter to women in particular, but they matter to all of us, and they get to the heart of the restrictions of rights and the oppression that is being pushed right now by the regime.
Yes, the women need to be in the front of things. And good news, they already are. They're already leading this thing in the U.S. Let's get behind them. Let's support the women who are in leadership. And don't forget, there are actual members, Christian nationalist pastors in the MAGA coalition who are literally making the argument right now that we need to repeal the 19th Amendment and take away women's right to vote. We need to publicize that. We need everyone in the country to understand that that is on the table. That is within the range of ideas that they are considering, because that should alarm our country. That should awaken people to the reality of what we're facing. All right. Number six in the playbook. Use non-cooperation. This can include boycotts and strikes, and this is why the labor movement is really key in resistance movements. It can include defections, disloyalty, government administrators slowing down approvals, and on and on. An authoritarian depends on systems. He can't do it alone. He can't do any of it alone. He issues orders, but those orders have to be implemented and enforced. Disobey. Disobey unlawful orders. We've seen some examples of this kind of non-cooperation growing in the U.S. Grand juries have already proven that they can really throw a wrench into Trump's efforts to prosecute his enemies because we have this check built into the system with grand juries. Now, most of the time, grand juries don't really do anything. They don't intervene because usually the system is working well. But now grand juries are starting to stop some of these prosecutions. Plenty of other juries aren't penalizing anti-ICE protesters, like the acquittal of the sandwich guy in D.C. Or remember, when some airport officials refused to show a Department of Homeland Security video that they deemed to be offensive. Or the CEO of JPMorgan Chase recently publicly really refused to support Trump's ballroom construction project. Or the Tesla takedown, where arguably that had a lot to do with why Elon Musk was forced to leave government, because his brand became unpopular through boycotts and protests.
Strikes, boycotts, these are also important. This week in Minneapolis, Postal Service workers are going to be marching to demand that the U.S. Postal Service not let its lots be used by ICE for staging their raids. They did that earlier this week. There were two Postal Service locations that were used as staging for ICE for raids where they then abducted some of our neighbors here in Minnesota. So the Postal Services, who are federal workers, the Postal Service workers who are federal workers, are doing a march and a rally organized by their union.
Excellent.
It's an important example of this kind of non-cooperation. And just to prove our point here, look at how much Trump freaked out when the Democratic legislators, who are veterans, reminded soldiers that they shouldn't carry out illegal orders.
And how right they were, right? How right they were.
Yeah. And he did that because he knows that if folks start not cooperating, he has no power. Strikes are so important because they really shut down systems dramatically. They're a really powerful tool. And like I said earlier, our labor movement in the U.S., which is how these strikes are organized, it has taken a hit over the past decade. But it's still there, and it's still organizing. It's got its eyes set on May Day. Stay tuned for that. And of course, for strikes to work, those who are striking need support from their community. If they're not going into work and getting their paycheck, they need to be supported by the wider community. And that's where things like mutual aid becomes so critical to sustain a movement. For all of this kind of non-cooperation, it's folks within the system that are particularly important at all levels and sectors of governments. It's the U.S. postal workers. It's the administrators within local government who are gumming up the system and slowing down the processes of permitting or implementing some of these orders. But it's also important for folks outside the government. So think, for example, of all that ICE depends on in order to operate in cities. They need hotels to stay in. They need restaurants to eat in. They need the airports and often private, sometimes commercial airlines in order to come into the cities. They need business parking lots to stage in. Refuse them these things. Refuse them access to services that facilitate their occupation of U.S. cities and their harassment of Americans.
Okay. Number 7 in our playbook is basically the thesis of this entire series. Connect with the broader global democratic resistance movement. Learn from the strategies and tactics that have been successful elsewhere. More people equals more power. And we shouldn't be limited by borders, even as we stay focused on our target in each context. Right? Recall how Israeli and American Jews are collaborating and coordinating, but they're each targeting their own governments and working within the systems that they live within. If we could make one plea to the reporters and the podcast hosts and the activist networks that are listening to this podcast, it would be this. Give the folks that we have interviewed on this podcast, but also the countless other diaspora scholars and experts in religious nationalism, a bigger platform. Learn from them. Interview them. We have only sampled a tiny fraction of the amazing expertise in religious nationalism that is right here in the U.S. We're in a remarkable position to foster these alliances here in the U.S. because these people are here. They're at our universities and our colleges. They are at our institutes. Let's draw upon the wealth of resources. And I can say, as a scholar who works in this kind of American Christian nationalism space, there are a lot of parts of the academic, podcast, mainstream media conversation about Christian nationalism here that have gotten really stale. It's the same experts, and I raise my hand as one of them that gets invited to do the same analysis, the same spiels, the same talking points. Let's open that conversation up more. Let's invite the expertise of the Joaos and the Raimundos and the Rays and the Nikhils and the Anants, the Reginas and the Sarahs and the Helens and the Davids and the Gitikas, the Italias, the Bins, Jonathans and Joels and the Aishas. Let's bring these people onto our podcast and into our media interviews and into our conversations. They have a lot to teach us in this moment.
Yeah. And they have a lot to offer in terms of analysis of Christian nationalism in the U.S. too, both the practical lessons and the analytical lessons. So ask them, what do you see going on in the U.S.? What do you see might work in terms of resisting this authoritarian capture and majoritarian religious nationalism? That's what we've been trying to model with this podcast. That is how we do the work of building a resilient resistance movement, one that hears from and listens to and shares the best ideas of how people around the world are learning from how to resist this rising tide of religious authoritarianism. And it's the scholars, as Matt said, they're critical, but it's also the activists and it's the religious leaders. And again, we have some of them in the U.S., but we also have access to them around the world. And particularly those who, you know, even those in totalitarian societies have connections to folks outside in diaspora too. So let's take advantage of the great reach that we have to build this global network, to share lessons, to create a people-powered movement that goes beyond our borders. Okay, finally, we wanted to really home in on our last points here about those elements of religious resistance in particular. There are secular forms of authoritarianism where this doesn't work as well, but when the authoritarianist grab of power is blended with a religious vocabulary and theology, non-religious language, it's not going to suffice to challenge this kind of power, this kind of legitimacy of anti-democratic movements. The solution to authoritarian religious nationalism is not less religion, but it's more of a particular kind of religion, one that is inclusive, respectful of democratic rights, including the separation of religion and state, a religion that's compassionate and that's ethically framed. And we have a lot of material within our traditions to advance this kind of religious frame, including within including within Christianity. Religion is so important that the last three items in our playbook are all about religion.
Yes. So point eight in our playbook, when resisting Christian nationalist authoritarianism, have Christians pushing back in language, vocabulary, rituals, theologies, and symbols of Christianity. And the same, as we've seen, could be applied to resisting most religious nationalist movements. We have a Christian nationalist movement here in the U.S., but you could swap out the words Christian in that sentence with Buddhist nationalism. When does Buddhist nationalism have Buddhists help lead the resistance? When does Islamic nationalism push back on it in Muslim terms and with Muslim voices? Now, this resistance, this theological resistance, can take the form of theologies, and we've talked a lot about liberation theologies in Christianity, Catholic social teaching, the apophaticism, right? This kind of via negativa of the Orthodox mysticism. I myself am right now finishing a book of theology pushing back against Christian nationalism and Christian imperialism and Christian supremacy from the model of Jesus in the early church. It's called Defying Tyrants. It'll be coming out in October, right? And those of us with training in theology right now, those of us with seminary degrees, those of us with PhDs, those of us who are pastors and priests,
the preachers,
now is the moment to employ our theological voices. Even if that's not our typical mode, now is the moment to lean into that. Now is the moment to speak up. But this can also be not just kind of voices and theologies and ideas. It can also be symbols and rituals, because symbols and rituals are important, right? Communion and the icons and liturgies, these can help sustain and fuel Christian resistance to Christian authoritarianism. And we have to do this carefully and thoughtfully, right? We have to pay attention to the warning that David Moe gave us in our episode discussing Myanmar. We don't want to unintentionally reinforce the idea that Christianity is the exclusive language of the nation, or that identity as an American means being Christian, right? Even if it's an inclusive and rights-defending Christianity, you can still get forms of kind of a religious nationalism that are more progressive, but not really inclusive, right? We want an inclusive movement, not Christian dominance in some other form, no matter how progressive it is. But that doesn't mean we should jettison speaking as Christians in Christian language. This is, I think, part of that contradiction that we're stuck in the United States between our modes of religious nationalism from our founding and the revolution and our modes of religious imperialism. I think it's left us kind of stuck and paralyzed and not feeling like we can use our religious voices. The key is to use those religious voices, use our Christian voices in ways that are building an inclusive coalition, a multi-religious, multi-ethnic coalition to stand up for the rights of everyone, right? That also celebrates and makes space for identities and faith languages that are outside of Christianity as also part of the definition of what it means to be American.
Great. Okay, number 9, enlist the clerics, the clergy, and the religious institutions of all religions. So this means churches, mosques, synagogues, gurdwaras, etc. Clerical authorities, and not only clerical authorities, so I also want to include in here lay leaders in faith communities. They have a level of moral authority that has power, right, within our society. And they have a relative degree of protection against state violence. Not entirely. We have seen religious clerics being attacked by tear gas, by ICE, and by the National Guard in Chicago and in Oakland and in other places. So they can also be attacked, but they do have a level of protection relative to some other members of society in this regard. So clerics, my fellow clergy people, do show up in these spaces. And as Matt said in an earlier episode, wear your doodads, wear your collars, wear your stoles, wear your prayer shawls, wear the garb that makes you stand out as a clergy person. And to the extent that you feel able to do so, put yourself in the way between the people and the actors who are trying to harm those people, because you have this particular role to play right now, standing up for the best of our values in defense of the people nonviolently. Finally, institutions. Places of worship, they serve such critical community gathering spaces within our society in the U.S. They convey information across broad swaths of our nation geographically. They are structures suited for mobilization and care and organization of a movement. They are arguably religious institutions, the churches, the strongest, the broadest para-state institution in our country, an institution that mirrors state institutions, which is precisely what makes them so dangerous to the state. They exist in rural and urban areas. They exist in blue states and red states. It was the organizing through the institution of the churches in the civil rights movement that was able to mobilize across this huge country that we have to mobilize a movement. So think about ways to draw on that institutional infrastructure of religion in order to sustain and support the movement. And then also, I think often about how my church, our individual churches and synagogues and so on, they serve as a cross sector of our society, some of the last remaining places in our society that truly bring together people across generations, across class, across political ideology and social background. And I say this even as a clergy person within the United Church of Christ, which is often associated with a very, you know, progressive political and social constituency. The reality is that we had a lot of UCCers vote for Trump in the last election. We too are a cross sector of American society within the United Church of Christ. But we share a moral language. We share a religious story that applies very neatly to the situation that we're facing right now in the U.S. when it comes to thinking about the political power and violence and care for neighbor and how we are called to respond to it following the example of Jesus. So these religious community places across the country, they're important locations for conversation and for mobilization. My fellow clergy members, I want you to tap into that possibility and use it. Map out within your own congregation the different constituencies and sectors of society that your own church connects to, and think about how to use that as a means to tap into this wider movement.
Yeah, churches are so important to this. And I mean, think back to the civil rights movement, right? Churches and clerics and clergy, they're at the forefront of this. And even today, I mean, you look around, where are the centers of resistance and mobilization? Churches are a very important part of that infrastructure. We can
make
them
true in a lot of movements in U.S. history, right?
Absolutely.
Abolition, women's rights movements, and so on. It was often churches or religious institutions that were serving as the mobilization and contributing to the language and created the people power organization to challenge an unjust state. There's a reason for that.
And clergy have been at the heart of it too. It's the institutions and the leaders. Okay, we come to the last of our 10 plays in our playbook. Number 10, creatively find or create uniquely Christian modes of resistance and use those publicly and prominently. Again, if you were doing this in other contexts, you could say uniquely Jewish or uniquely Hindu. But in the U.S., because we have this Christian nationalist movement that is so powerful, we need to find Christian modes of resistance, right? And consider from the examples of religious resistance we've seen across our different case studies, right? Buddhist monks, Theravada Buddhist monks, turning over their alms bowls to condemn the military in Myanmar. Or these courageous Orthodox nuns and priests resisting clerical authorities in and outside of Russia. Or religious activists shaving their heads in the public square in Korea. Or the protest iconography in Poland that is trying to use national and religious symbols to push back, right? Reclamation of these Christian liberation theologies in Brazil, or the pluralist theologies within Hinduism, Jewish liturgical rituals in the midst of protests in Tel Aviv, or punk protest prayers at the heart of the Russian Orthodox Church in its cathedrals. Even in the U.S., we have some really interesting recent examples of this. There's a nativity at Lake Street Church in Evanston, Illinois, that depicts the baby Jesus with his hands zip-tied and wrapped in one of those aluminum foil blankets they give to migrants. And in the same one, Mary is wearing a gas mask over her face to avoid tear gas. And there are centurions looking on dressed as ICE agents. We're using religious symbolism. And the Holy Family, Mary, Jesus, and Joseph, they were refugees. This is not some extraneous kind of analogy. There's something very concrete here. Or there was a Catholic church in Dedham, Massachusetts, that made it quite plain. They had the nativity scene, but Jesus, Mary, and Joseph were missing, and there's a big sign that says, ICE was here. These things get noticed. They get media attention. They get written up in national media. In fact, the Catholic parish in Dedham, Massachusetts, even had the archbishop tell them to take the sign down and put Mary, Jesus, and Joseph back. And so far, they have resisted, and they're demanding a meeting with the archbishop. Rock on, Catholics in Dedham, Massachusetts. That is some grade A non-compliance. So when we're coming up with these ideas, when we're trying to use these symbols, use the kind of uniquely Christian modes, let your creativity fly. What contributions to this inspiring repertoire of religious resistance might we as American Christians offer? What forms of ritual or symbols or national symbols that we can actually attach to more religious messages? How can we contribute to this incredible bouquet that we see around the globe?
Yeah. And in this, you know, you said Christian symbolism is particularly important in ritual, and 100% for the reasons we've named, because we're trying to dismantle Christian nationalism and challenge it. But with our diverse coalitions, we also have the potential to draw in some of those incredible forms of Jewish liturgy
Yes.
into the street protests or, you know, form our Muslim siblings to be able to contribute prayer. The other day I was at a gathering with Somali Muslims, and they actually got the call to prayer happened, and they got down on the street in the cold and ice and did their prayer, and we all created a protective circle around them. It was powerful. There's another idea that's percolating here in Minnesota that's reminding me of what you're talking about, Matt. A big, bold action on Palm Sunday and another on Eid in May. And then all of that is part of a movement towards July 4th, the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence with the military parade in U.S. The idea is inaugurating on Palm Sunday a people's parade led by Jesus to challenge the military parade of Pilate slash Trump on that day. It's meant to be a reenactment of the biblical Palm Sunday story. So again, it has this potential power to collapse history and the present, to bring our sacred story with all that it invokes and inspires and challenges into the current moment. Okay, so it's a little weird to have a list that's 11. So we're not calling this number 11, but we do want to make one more point. We're calling it bonus or extracurricular. And this is another lesson that I want to offer you from the women in that living room in 2016. It is to take care of your souls, beloveds. This is a marathon. So I want you to ground yourself in spiritual practices, to bathe yourself in prayer, to sing, to take moments to put your phone down, to turn it off even, and to not listen to podcasts or the news, to unplug. Do some art. I do ceramics because it literally, my hands are a mess and I can't pick up my phone even if I wanted to. Use what works for you. And ideally, do these kinds of practices and soul care in community. Because being in community is critical for anyone who is experiencing trauma or is experiencing heightened anxiety. And that's all of us right now. We are marinating in this very stressful soup and we're being inundated with bad news constantly. So the antidote to despair is connection. So find community and plug into it, whether it's a faith community or whether it's other forms of neighborhood gatherings or singing circles or whatever it is. This is going to ensure your sustainability, our sustainability. It's also going to help you to ensure that when you do show up into these spaces, whether you're confronting state actors directly or whether you're making meals for your immigrant neighbors to ensure they don't have to go out when they're feeling threatened, that you're able to show up in those spaces in ways that are grounded, that you are connected and in your body, that you're better able to respond in the public square in ways that are thoughtful and powerful and constructive and loving. It's so critical. So take care of your souls, everybody. Do what you need to do to take care of your spirit. At the end of every episode in our outro, you have heard me say, we are not alone. We aren't. We might feel isolated sometimes. We might feel we're battling something, some force that's much bigger, much more powerful than us and the handful of folks in our lives who are activated. Look again. We're starting to see the connections that are being built within neighborhoods, within cities, across state lines. The isolation we might have felt in that long pandemic period, the walls that have been created by social media, by polarization, they are starting to crumble. New nodes and networks are firing up all across this country. And we're not alone on a global level as well. There are activists, scholars, religious actors from around the world who are reaching out to us to offer solidarity and support, their hard-earned lessons. All you have to do is reach back out. The global movement is there, ready to welcome you in. So thank you, everyone, for joining us on this journey around the world. And may we all keep showing up for the resistance together. That's it for this episode of American Unexceptionalism. Thanks for joining us.
Please hit subscribe and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts.
You can keep up with this show and all the other great series from Axis Mundi Media at www.axismundi.us.
This show is produced by Andrew Gill and engineered by Scott Okamoto. Funding provided by the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies, Princeton Theological Seminary, and the International Center on Religion and Diplomacy.
Remember, the struggle for democracy is global, and we aren't alone.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.